Windy Butte, New Mexico, The Traveler Book 6, written by J.C. Hulsey, narrated by Chaz Allen. Chapter 1. While visiting with Uncle Justin and Aunt Abigail at their potato farm in Itching Tree, Idaho, I was lollygagging around and feeling sorry for myself because I had to tell the girl that I deeply cared for that I would be leaving town and not returning. That was after I received a telegram from the mayor of Windy Butte, New Mexico. A double bolt of lightning zigzagged and streaked across the sky, bringing right behind it the rumble of distant thunder. It looked as if it was going to be a gully washer. I pushed my leather hat back off my forehead and opened the telegram. It was from Mayor Madison of Windy Butte, New Mexico. I had taken care of a problem they had when we passed through there on our way to Velvet Sky, Arizona, and it seemed that they now had a similar situation. The new sheriff they hired was causing all kinds of trouble. He had taken over the town and was demanding that everyone do exactly as he said, or else. He hadn't killed anyone yet, but the mayor felt it was just a matter of time before he did. This was the kind of mission I felt God had ordained me to handle, alleviating trouble where and whenever needed. I also needed to see if the mayor had lived up to his promise of allowing his young daughter, Melody, to have more freedom in her life. I stuffed the telegram in my shirt pocket and stepped indoors to tell my friends of our new journey, just as the rain started pouring down. I decided that since it was so far away, that I would take the train. I had never ridden a train before. As a kid, I saw a lot of them when they stopped or passed through Angel Falls. I went over the plan with Orville and Half Loaf, and they would follow with the horses and wagon and meet me in Windy Butte in a little over a month. We told Uncle Justin and Aunt Abigail how much we enjoyed our visit, and they were very sad that I was leaving. I explained to both of them that this was what God wanted me to do. People needed me to help them in New Mexico. "You will remember our talk about you coming and living with us, won't you?" asked Uncle Justin. "You can't begin to understand how happy it makes me to know that I'm wanted like that," I said. "I just can't stay when I'm needed elsewhere. I hope you understand." "You'll be in our prayers," said Uncle Justin, "but I want you to be extra careful as you travel to unknown dangers. I gave Orville 100 pounds of potatoes, so I guess you'll be eating potatoes for a while. We need to get into town so I can get a ticket and board the train. I will be praying for you and thinking of you each day," I told him. "Goodbye." Chapter 2. When we got to the train station, there was one of the prettiest girls I had ever seen sitting on the platform. "I believe I would like to take a train trip, if that girl is going to be riding also," said Half Loaf. "Half Loaf, you know you have to travel with and help Orville. He might get lost without your young eyes to see for him," I said.
"Oh, come on, Jed," said Orville. "You know I got eyes like a hawk."
"I know," I said. "I'm just joshing you. You and Half Loaf take good care of Sugar for me. I really will miss my horse," I said.
"Ain't gonna miss us?" asked Orville.
"I thought that was a given," I said. "You both should know by now how much I care for you." I walked over to the ticket office to inquire about a ticket. He said first class to Windy Butte, New Mexico, would cost me $85, and a second class ticket would cost $45. I asked what the difference was between first class and second class, and he told me first class was a sleeping berth, which meant the seats turned into a bed for sleeping. A second class was just a seat, nothing fancy. And then there was the immigrant car. It has one long bench running the entire length of the car. He said it was usually filled with Chinese railroad workers. "The train will be stopping once a day for the noon meal," the clerk said. "That'll cost $1 for each one." I figured since it was only going to take about 3 or 4 days, I would get a second-class ticket. I paid him the $45, and he handed me the ticket. Then I walked back to where the guys were waiting for me.
"Well, did you get it? Let me see it. I ain't never seen a train ticket before."
"Please, I would like to see also," said Half Loaf. I showed them both the ticket.
"Why, that ain't nothing but a piece of cardboard, and a very thin cardboard at that," said Orville.
"No, it's a lot more than that," I said. "It's the key to the door of a new adventure."
"Boy, you sure are talking fancy today."
"I'm not talking any different than I do any other time," I said.
"Sure sounds fancy," said Orville. "How about I know what you're doing? You're practicing for when you meet that pretty girl that's fixing to get on the train."
"Well, you could be right about that," I said. "Let's go get something to eat. I think I'd like some barbecued ribs before I leave." We walked to Pfluger's eatery and ordered 3 servings of ribs with 3 glasses of iced tea. Then we talked about the trip they were going to have to take with the wagon and animals.
I figure it's going to be a lot like our last trip without you. Boring and more boring. Sure wish we didn't have to split up, fussed Orville.
I wish we didn't either, I said. But the mayor said the sheriff could kill somebody at any time. That's why I have to hurry. You fellas will be all right. It's just a little over 800 miles.
Well, I probably need to go to Perkins Emporium and stock up with supplies, said Orville.
I'd go with you, I said, but I've already told Jennifer goodbye, and there's no reason to open old wounds. You guys go ahead. I'll just visit with Jonah at the blacksmith shop and have him check Sugar's left rear shoe. I think it may have worked loose.
Chapter 3. They went in one direction and I went in the other. I stopped by the livery stable and got Sugar. Then I walked 2 streets down to the blacksmith shop. I could hear the sounds of metal hitting metal from quite a distance away. When I got to the door of the shop, there he was, swinging that hammer like he was mad at the piece he was hitting. I stood there waiting for a break in his swings. I guess he felt my presence because he turned, and when he saw me, his eyes lit up and his shiny white teeth broke into a wide smile that seemed to light up the entire room. He was very distinguished-looking, with his tight, curly gray hair. You could tell from his composure that he was content with his life. It was a pleasure just being in the same room with him.
"Hello there, Jed. Glad you came back. I heard that you're going to be leaving soon."
"Yes, word travels fast in a town like Itching Tree. Sure glad you came to see me before you go."
"Well, I'm glad to see you, too," I said.
"I also need something. So the visit isn't entirely personal. I need you to take a look at Sugar's left rear shoe. Felt like it was loose last time I rode her."
"I'm still glad to see you," he said. "When you figuring on leaving?"
"Oh, the train leaves at 3:30.
"If you don't mind a little advice, I'd recommend taking a basket of food with you," he said.
"The stops between meals gets awfully long, and then they sometimes ain't very good anyhow. Take my word for it, take a basket."
"Well, thank you, Jonah," I said. "I wanted to thank you again for the kind words you said about my pa."
"Didn't say nothing that wasn't true," he said. "Your pa was one of the finest, and I would say his boy is turning out just like him. May the good Lord bless you and keep you as you travel down this road he has placed you on."
"Well, goodbye, Jonah," I said, "and God bless you."
I turned and walked back to Pfluger's eatery to see about a basket of food to take with me. There was one other place I wanted to go before I left. I walked through the alley and came out on Main Street and then stood at the corner of the building and waited, looking across the street at Perkins Emporium. I felt I had to look at her one last time, and I stood on that corner until it was time to go to the train depot, and never did get to see Jennifer. Orville and Halfloaf were waiting at the depot for me.
There you are, said Orville. It's getting late. I was wondering where you were.
Oh, I took Sugar over to the blacksmith shop to get her shoes checked, I said.
You need to pick her up either today or tomorrow.
Sure gonna miss you guys. You're the best friends a man could have. Please be safe as you travel to meet me. I figure it'll take a little more than a month for you to get there. Did you get all the supplies you needed?
Yeah, we got 'em, said Orville. Reckon it's time to say goodbye. So long, Jed. We'll see you when we see you.
Goodbye, Jed, said Halfloaf. I will pray for you each night.
You 2 good friends will be in my prayers too, I said.
Chapter 4. The train was just pulling into the station, and we stood back out of the way while the passengers got off. Then I picked up my bag and was climbing aboard when I spotted that good-looking young lady struggling with her trunk. I jumped back on the platform and walked over to her.
"Excuse me, ma'am. Didn't you check your trunk when you bought your ticket?" I said.
"I didn't know I was supposed to," she said. "This will be my first time to ride a train."
"That's my first time, too," I said. "Here, let me help you with that."
I pulled the trunk over to one of the freight cars and banged on the door. It pushed open, and a man stuck his head out.
"Yeah, what you need?"
"Well, this young lady didn't check her trunk when she bought her ticket. Can you load it for her?"
"Sure thing," he said.
He pushed the door open wider.
"Toss it right up here."
Well, I struggled to lift the trunk, but finally got it over the edge of the door.
"I got it now," he said. "Thanks for the help."
I turned to the young lady and introduced myself. "My name's Jed Jenkins. I'm going to Windy Butte, New Mexico. Where might you be going?"
Well, I'm Pamela Hunsacker, and I'm going to teach school in Neville's Brand, Nevada.
Aren't you a little young to be a school teacher? I asked.
I'll be 23 next July. I graduated with honors from Miss Pritchett's School for Young Women. In fact, I was number one out of 15 students.
Well, that's very impressive, I said. Your folks must be very proud.
Oh, my parents died when I was 11. I was sent to live in Applegate's orphanage. I was very lucky to be appointed to attend Miss Pritchett's school.
You said you were going to Windy Butte, New Mexico? Are you visiting kinfolk there?
No, I said. I have a sort of job there.
If I might be so bold, might I inquire what kind of job?
Well, I'm going there to persuade a man to leave town or die.
That sounds dangerous, she said, especially if he doesn't want to do either one.
Oh, I assure you he will do one or the other, I said.
You're a gunfighter, aren't you?
There have been some who called me that, I said. I don't consider myself a gunfighter. More of a person who helps those in need. I do everything I can to bring the situation to a conclusion without gunplay, but if I can't, then someone's gonna die.
Have you ever considered that person might be you? She asked.
Yes, that thought has entered my mind, but then I remember who I work for, and it erases that thought.
Well, who do you work for that can bring peace of mind that easy?
The Lord God Almighty is the one I work for, I said. He has ordained me to travel the country, rooting out evil and destroying it.
Well, you sound like a preacher.
Well, maybe I am sort of like a preacher. He leads folks to the Lord, and I either lead them or take them to meet their Maker.
I'm not sure I condone what you do, she said.
Well, that's your privilege, ma'am. Someday you might change your mind.
I doubt that. Please sit someplace else, if you don't mind.
Yes, ma'am, I said, and good day to you. I moved to the other end of the car completely away from her. As the car rolled from side to side, I leaned back as best I could on the seat, pulled my hat down over my eyes, and dozed off.
When I woke up, it was dark outside. The sights through the window were like shadows rushing by. I was unable to distinguish them from one another. They seemed to be melting together into one big line. The moon and stars were another matter. They seemed to be glued in one spot. The only thing moving was the train. Just about then, I spotted a lightning bolt streaking down from the heavens and striking the ground not too far away. Even on a speeding train, I could still be amazed at the wonders of God's creation. I decided to try and sleep some more. I glanced at Pamela. She looked uncomfortable, but was refusing to look in my direction. So be it. Before I closed my eyes, I looked out the window and saw raindrops dancing up and down like ghosts marching along the glass. I pulled my hat down and went to sleep. The next time I woke, the train was stopped. The conductor said they had to fill a locomotive with water and load up with wood. Probably going to take 30 minutes or more. This would allow passengers to take a comfort break. They could use the hole-in-the-floor urinals or, if lucky, find an outhouse to answer the call of nature. We were lucky this time. The station stop had an outhouse behind the main building. I glanced up just as Pamela got back on the train. She still wasn't looking at me.
All aboard! All aboard! Cried the conductor.
Chapter 5. The train jerked as it took off. Before long, the clickety-clack of the wheels became so familiar it almost put me to sleep. The next morning, I opened my basket and ate a sandwich made of meatloaf. Even cold, Pfluger's meatloaf was delicious, and I noticed I was the only passenger with a basket. I got up and walked back to where Pamela was sitting and said, "Would you care for a sandwich?"
"No, thank you. I'm not hungry."
"Suit yourself," I said. I had just gotten situated in my seat when I looked out the window and saw two men with masks riding beside the train. This didn't look good. Right about now, I was glad I had packed my pistol in my haversack. I opened it, reached in, and tucked my pistol inside my shirt. The door next to Pamela slammed open, and a man with a gun stepped through. He was of medium build with long hair down to his collar, but I couldn't see his face because of the mask. The door next to me slammed open, and another hombre stepped inside.
"Everybody do what you're told. Nobody gets hurt. Y'all understand? Now, put all your valuables in this here sack, and we'll be on our way," he said loudly.
The one next to me started walking down the aisle with his back to me. People were putting their jewelry and money into the bag. The bandit at the other end of the car looked down and saw Pamela.
"Well, look what we got here. Hello, pretty thing. How'd you like to come along with me?
I could show you a really good time. Would you like that? He said. He reached down and grabbed her arm. I stood with my pistol in my hand and said, I think you need to turn the young lady loose. She doesn't like gunfighters. Who the hell you think you are? And he pushed her back down in the seat. The other man turned, and as he got turned almost all the way around, my bullet pushed him over the seat. He hung there for just a second before sliding onto the floor. I wouldn't point that weapon in this direction, I said to the other man. It could get you killed just like your partner. His eye twitched just a tad as he started to raise his gun. It didn't get all the way up because he fell backwards through the door as my bullet entered his forehead. I replaced the two cartridges and put my pistol back inside my bag. Everyone was very excited and began talking all at once. The conductor came by and congratulated me for a job well done. Will you be stopping the train to bury these gentlemen? I asked. No, I'll have them moved to the baggage car, and they will be turned over to the undertaker in the next town. Thank you for explaining that to me, I said. I looked at Pamela, and she was mighty pale. She glanced up at me and smiled, shyly. I nodded to her and sat back down on my seat, ready to watch the shadows rush by. I was dozing a little when I felt a tap on my shoulder. I looked up from under the brim of my hat and saw Pamela standing there. Chapter 6 May I sit with you? She asked shyly. Of course, I said, and I scooted over. She sat down, wringing her handkerchief in her lap. I don't know what to say. I'm embarrassed. You saved me after I treated you so badly. I'm so sorry. Will you accept my apology? Nothing to apologize for, I said. You're entitled to your beliefs, just like everyone else. I think my beliefs may have been altered just a little bit, she said. We visited a lot, sitting there next to each other on that hard seat. She told me about how her parents had died and how she went to the orphanage. Then how a rich old lady took her in and taught her how to be a lady and even helped her get enrolled in Miss Pritchard's school for young ladies. She told me how she had studied hard, not going out at all, just sleeping and studying, and that she graduated at the top of her class. And now she had a job teaching in Neville's Brand, Nebraska. Oh, I can hardly wait, she said. I'm so excited. I just know I'm going to love being a teacher, helping those young minds to expand, to grow, and grasp all that knowledge that God intends for us. I'm very happy for you, I said. I'm sure you will be a very good teacher. We also talked about why I was traveling the country, doing what I do. And she said, I just can't understand why you have to be the one to settle things. Why can't the law do that? Well, if we had waited on the law when that man attacked you, where would you be? I said. I suppose I see what you mean. I wonder how much further it is to my stop. Next time the conductor comes by, I'll ask him, I said. It's the next stop, the conductor said. Should be about 25 more minutes. Well, then I reckon we better say our goodbyes now, I said. I don't think the train stops for long. Just enough time to let the passengers off, and that means you. The train pulled into the station and stopped. Neville's Brand, Neville's Brand, the conductor said. Stop for 10 minutes. We stood. Pamela reached up and kissed me on the cheek. I want to tell you again how sorry I am for misjudging you when we first met. I shouldn't have jumped to any conclusions, at least until after I got to know you a little bit better. If you ever come to this town, please look me up. I would be proud to have dinner with you. That is, unless I find a young man just like you and I'm having dinner with him. Goodbye, Jed. Goodbye, Pamela. It was a pleasure getting to know you, and I'll be praying for you. Thank you, and goodbye again, she said, and there were tears running down her cheeks as she left the train. When she reached the platform, she turned and raised her hand in a parting gesture. All aboard! All aboard! Said the conductor as the train jerked and began picking up speed almost immediately. I guess it was the rocking motion of the car, but I was feeling drowsy again. Chapter 7 I guess I slept for about 4 hours, and when I woke, it was raining so hard I couldn't see anything out the window. I pulled my pocket watch out of my shirt and checked the time. Should be there in another half hour. I could feel a train start to slow down. It was still raining, so I couldn't see anything. The train jerked and stopped completely, and I stood up, a little stiff from dozing on that hard seat. I stretched and picked up my haversack. I wondered if Mayor Madison was going to meet me here at the station, since I sent him a telegram about when to expect me. I stepped down onto the platform. It was raining so hard I couldn't see the train depot. I ducked my head and ran in the direction I thought it would be. As I drew closer, I could make out the buildings and turn to the door. I pushed it open and stepped inside, out of the rain. Mayor Madison was standing just inside the door, wringing his hands.
"Jed, my boy, so glad you made it. I wasn't sure you would come, even after I received your telegram. After all, this town and its people are nothing to you."
"But that's my job," I said, "taking care of things that others don't want to take care of. Now tell me about the trouble."
"It's like I said in the telegram," the mayor said. "The new sheriff is trying to take over the town. He's a real bully. If he tells a person to do something and they don't do it, he either locks them in the jail or he beats them up. It's seeming more and more like he enjoys hurting people. I'm afraid if he keeps going the way he is, somebody will get killed."
"And the citizens won't do anything to get rid of him?" I asked. "They could band together and it would be one of him against a crowd."
"All the people in this town can't get along enough to cross the street together," the mayor said.
"No, there's no one. No one but you."
"All right," I said. "I'll get a room at the hotel. First thing tomorrow, I'll meet you at your office, then check this sheriff out. How's that sound?"
"Well, I don't have an office anymore," the mayor said. "I'm not the mayor. I was asked to resign because I was the one that hired this new sheriff. The town council voted me out, but let me resign. And, Jed, all of this is not my biggest problem."
"Well, you sound serious," I said.
"I am," said the mayor. "Melody is in jail. They're saying she's going to hang."
"Go ahead and tell me about it," I said.
"Right after you left Windy Butte last year, Melody met a young man named Chester Wilkins, works at the bank. One day, Melody was taking Chester his lunch, and while she was there, the bank was robbed. Melody has always been able to shoot a gun. I taught her at a very young age, so she was carrying a pistol in her purse, and as the bandits were leaving with the money, there was a shootout. Melody shot at one of the robbers, and an innocent bystander was killed. They claim it was Melody's bullet that killed him."
"Now, when did this happen?" I asked. "Was anybody else hurt?"
"It just happened yesterday," said the mayor. "One of the robbers was hit, but we don't know how badly or where he was hit. People are so mad at me for hiring the sheriff, I think they're taking out their anger on Melody."
"Well, as soon as I take care of the sheriff," I said, "I'll have a talk with Melody. I don't think she's going to hang. Not if I have a say-so in the matter."
"Thank you, Jed. I figured I could count on you," said the mayor.
The next morning I walked to the Madison's house and talked a bit with the mayor. He was still mayor to me. He explained how this vermin wound up with the badge.
"He had extremely good references when he came here," said the mayor.
"Did you check them to see if they were legitimate?" I asked.
"Well, no. They were so good I didn't feel the need. I guess I learned a hard lesson there, didn't I?"
"Well, it's over with now," I said. "Just be more careful in the future."
"Yes, I will, said the mayor.
"How's your family doing? How's Theodore?"
"Well, Theodore passed away almost 6 months ago," the mayor said. "It was very sudden. One day he was fine, and the next day he was gone. I'm lost without him. He helped me with everything. It will be extremely hard to replace him."
I don't mean replace him. Well, I believe you know what I'm trying to say, don't you?"
"Yes, I understand completely," I said.
"You'll never be able to replace him in your heart."
"I'm hoping Chester, my son-in-law, will quit the bank and come help me here," the mayor said. "He's very smart, and he should learn the business real quick."
"Well, good luck with that. I need to go take care of our business now," I said.
"You say he hangs out at the saloon on Main Street?"
"Yes, if he's not there, you might check the cafe. He eats breakfast there all the time," said the mayor.
Then he said, "We'll be needing a new sheriff after today. Would you at least consider it?"
"I think you know the answer to that question," I said. "Now, don't you?"
"I suppose I do. However, I do wish you'd reconsider. We need someone who is honest and dependable and doesn't abuse the office.
As I said on more than one occasion, I'm not going to be yours or anybody else's sheriff."
"Good day to you," I said. "Please give my best to your lovely wife. I'll go see Melody as soon as I've dispensed of the sheriff."
"I appreciate that so much," said the mayor. "Thank you, Jed. Please be careful."
"I'll do that. See you later."
Chapter 8
I walked from the Madison house to the saloon where the sheriff is supposed to hang out. There in front of the saloon was an old man, reared back in his chair with his feet propped up on the rails, smoking a cigar. Set his chair down flat, stood, and extended a grimy hand.
"Name's Lightning Jack Martin, 'cause I'm so fast, in case you're wondering. If y'all need help in there, you can depend on me."
"Thank you, but no, I don't need any help," I said.
"You're mighty young to be doing something like this."
"Well, I'm not too young for this particular job. Now, if you'll excuse me," and I pushed my way through the swinging doors and stood just inside, waiting for my eyes to adjust to the dim light. The noise stopped as everyone turned and stared at me. I scanned the room until I spotted a large man with a badge pinned on his vest. He was probably close to 400 pounds and wearing dark trousers with a dark leather vest over a white shirt and a string tie. His Colt 45 was tied down, and I noticed the leather tie-down for the hammer was missing. I walked over, stopped about a foot in front of him, and said, "You the sheriff?"
"You need glasses or something? Can't you see the badge?"
"I see the badge all right," I said. "But it takes more than a badge to make a sheriff."
"What's that supposed to mean?" he said.
"Means you're abusing your authority as sheriff."
"And just who are you to be making statements like that?"
"Well, my name's Jedediah Jenkins, and I'm here to put an end to your tyranny."
"My what?"
"I'm asking you nicely to turn in your badge and resign."
"And if I don't?"
"Then I'm ordering you to turn in your badge, or one of us is going to get hurt, and I'm not planning on it being me. Now, why don't you just unpin that badge and lay it there on the bar? I'll accept that as your resignation."
"Now, what authority do you have to ask for my resignation?"
"The mayor appointed me as special officer of the court."
"Well, I don't believe I'm going to resign," said the sheriff.
Just as his gun was being lifted out of the holster, my 45 pressed hard against his throat. His bushy gray eyebrows raised in disbelief.
"I recommend you relax, or this gun might just go off," I said.
He dropped his gun back into its holster.
"Now hold on," he said. "Maybe I'll reconsider. Believe I will resign. Just don't pull that trigger. Please take that gun out of my throat."
"I will, but first I want you to listen to each word that comes out of my mouth very carefully. Do you think you can do that?" And I pushed the barrel against his throat a little harder. He barely nodded his head, indicating that he understood.
"That's good," I said. "That's very good. Now here's what you're going to do. You'll unpin your badge and lay it there on the bar. And then you'll take your pistol out of your holster and lay it on the bar. Do you understand?"
Take it easy. Look, I'm taking it off," he said as he removed the badge and laid it on the bar.
"Now the gun."
He reached down and lifted it out of the holster, then laid it next to the badge on the bar. "Now, I would suggest that you mosey on down to the livery stable, saddle your horse, and head in any direction," I said. "Leave town, don't look or come back. Ever. Understand? I would be very upset if one day I looked up and saw your ugly face."
"Yes, sir. I understand completely. I'm out of here," he said.
And with that, he walked out the door and started running towards the livery stable. The men in the bar began laughing and talking about how things were going to be better now that their sheriff was gone. I put my pistol back in the holster, and ignoring the people trying to talk to me, I walked straight to the jail, opened the door, and went inside. Chapter 9. Melody looked at me through the bars with her brown eyes fluttering her long eyelashes. She had sort of a hangdog expression on her pretty face.
"I didn't shoot that fellow, Jed. I'm a better shot than that. I always hit what I aim at. I haven't missed a target since I was a little girl. Papa is a very good teacher. I'm innocent, Jed. I know where my shot went. It's in the shoulder of the youngest bandit. If you could find him, wouldn't that be enough to prove I'm innocent?"
"Maybe," I said, "but I have to find him first, and I need to find him fast. He could bleed to death before I find him. Then we'd have no proof."
"Tell me again what they look like." The only way to prove her innocence was to track down the bandits and bring them back to own up to the killing. That was the job I had to do to save Melody's life. No one but her could give me a description of these men, and she wasn't too clear, so I was basically searching in the dark.
I did, however, have a good description of their horses. I had 1 month to find them, convince them to return, and save Melody's life. My work was cut out for me. I walked to the livery stable to rent a horse. The owner remembered me from when I was here before.
"I understand that you took care of our problem, Sheriff," he said.
"Yes, he's moved on," I said, "so he's someone else's problem now. Listen, I need to rent a horse so I can go after those bank robbers."
"Seems like you're mighty busy," the livery owner said. "First the sheriff, now the bank robbers."
"Melody Madison is a friend of mine, and I have to run down these two men and bring them back so she won't hang and can go free."
"Downright shame the way that family's being treated," he said. "First kicking the mayor out of office when he hired that crooked sheriff, then throwing his daughter in jail. Don't believe any of them really believe she's guilty. They're just trying to get back at the mayor. That's what I think."
"Or you could be right, old-timer. Say, what's your name? I can't keep calling you old-timer."
"My name's Joshua Coggins. Joshua to my friends. Just plain Josh to my close friends, which includes you."
"Thanks a lot, Mr. Coggins. Josh. Now, how about that horse?"
"I got just the horse you need. Follow me," he said.
"Right here's one of the best animals in the county." The horse was almost a twin to my horse, Sugar.
"What's her name?" I asked.
"I call her Beauty, because that's exactly what she is."
"I'm going to need a saddle, too. How much for a couple of days?"
"Oh, I wouldn't think of charging one of my good friends." "No, you take her for as long as you need, and it won't cost you one red cent."
"Well, I'm not going to argue with you right now. I'm in too much of a hurry," I said. "I'll see you later, Josh."
"So long, Jed. Keep your head down and your powder dry," he said. I loaded up with supplies and tightened Beauty's cinch and then mounted up, took off in the direction witnesses said they went. The sun was setting in the west and shining directly in my eyes. I pulled the brim of my leather hat down to shade my eyes, then kicked Beauty in the ribs, and she started to gallop. I didn't have much time, and if running her for a spell would help, then so be it. The road was dusty from lack of rain. Hiding places were plentiful here in the high rocky cliffs and on each side of the road. There were plenty of places for an ambush, and I was doing the best I could to be alert and watchful. I sure didn't want this trip to end before it got started.
Chapter 10. The wind picked up, and the trees were bending with the force as dark clouds began to gather behind the distant hills. I came to a deserted town, dismounted, and tied Beauty's reins to a broken hitching post, then proceeded to walk down the side of the street. There was a bakery, a Chinese laundry on one end, and a hotel with a saloon in the center, and a livery stable on the other end. There were a lot of abandoned buildings that could be used for an ambush. Storm clouds blotted out the rays of the sun, causing a darkness to cover the town. If it was hard before, now it would be doubly hard to spot anyone hiding in any of these buildings. I was almost to the middle of town when a bullet whizzed by my head and lodged in the corner post holding up a porch. I ducked down behind an empty water trough, and another bullet blasted a piece off the edge of it. I needed to get under better cover without getting shot. Those rounds sounded like they were from the same gun, and it wasn't a rifle. He had fired twice and missed twice. If I could get him to miss four more times, then I could run for cover while he reloaded. The sky began to clear as I raised up a tad and caused the sun to shine directly into my eyes. I was as blind as I was when the clouds were covering the sun. Another shot rang out, and I thought I could see where the shots were coming from. It was the upstairs window of the hotel across the street. Three more shots, and I'd give it a try. I scooted to the other end of the trough. Another shot. Another miss. I looked around, and there on the ground next to the boardwalk was a piece of wood that had broken off from the roof. Who knew where? It didn't matter. What mattered was I needed a piece of that wood. I reached for it, and a bullet barely missed my hand. This fellow was a fairly good shot. One more shot, and I was moving. I hoped he had only one pistol, and I reached for the piece of wood with my foot, got it, and tried to drag it over so I could reach it with my hand. Then I raised up and moved it back and forth. Pow! The board flew out of my hand. I got up and ran across the street to the abandoned hotel, where the shots were coming from. Chapter 11. I slipped through the half-open door, careful not to expose myself. I was pretty sure he was upstairs and wondered how I was going to climb the stairs without him seeing or hearing me. What if one was upstairs and the other downstairs? What a fix I would be in.
I walked slowly, hanging against the wall, until I reached the bottom of the stairs. I didn't see or hear anything, but he could have been watching me. I stepped on the first step. It squeaked. Of course it did. The second, the fourth. I took them two at a time. I reached the first landing, clung to the wall, and peeked around the archway. Nothing. Where was the shooter? I started down the hallway when I heard a groan. He was hurt. But where was his partner? Was he just waiting, just inside the door? I stepped up close to the door and put my ear against it. Nothing. Then I heard it again, a low groan, real low. I pushed on the door, but something was keeping it from opening. I pushed harder, and it opened a little more. I continued putting pressure on it until I could look around it, and finally I saw him over by the window. He didn't look too good. His face was very pale, almost white. If he didn't get help soon, he was probably going to die. I walked over to him, kicked away his pistol, then knelt down and listened to his breathing. I barely felt his breath. What was I going to do? I needed to keep him alive. I stood up and looked around for anything that might help. Over in the corner, I saw his canteen. I walked over, picked it up, shook it. It was just about half full. I wet my bandana and wiped his face, and he started mumbling. I knelt down close and listened.
George left me here to die, that sorry scoundrel. Took all the money, too. Not going to make it, am I?
You hang in there, I said. You're going to be all right. Here, just a sip of water. He coughed as he tried to swallow. I'm going to turn you over, I said, so I can see if that bullet went all the way through. He groaned loudly as I moved him. There was no exit wound, so the bullet was still in there. If I could get it out, he might have a chance. I wished Orville was here. He was better at this than I was. Can't wish for something I can't have, so I better get to it. I dug my pocket knife from my trousers. Sure needed to be cleaned. Orville would heat it by a fire. Maybe I could build one right in the middle of the floor. I could put it out before it burned the building down. I gathered up all the paper and kicked one of the drawers from the dresser. It broke into a few small pieces. I started a fire and stuck the knife blade in the flames. While it was heating, I tore open his shirt so I could get to the wound. I felt and searched for the location of the bullet. If I pulled the wound apart, I could see it, and it was lodged against the bone. I stood and walked over to the fire. The knife blade was glowing red, so I wrapped my bandana around my hand and picked it up. I walked back over to him, knelt down, and went to work. But first I took one of the pieces of wood and placed it between his teeth. "Bite down on this," I said. "It'll help the pain." I started pushing the blade into the wound. I worked it around and under the projectile, and it slipped right out as I pushed up with the blade. I went over and kicked the fire out and washed the wound with water. I tore the bottom of his shirt, wrapped it around him, and covered the wound. He needed some whiskey to shock him a little, and maybe there was some in the saloon next door. I headed over and began to search for some liquor. All the bottles were empty, and most were broken, so I went into the back room. There was a bunch of crates stacked in the far corner. I started pulling and pushing them away from the wall as the rats and mice scattered. There in the corner, hiding from all to see, was a lone bottle of Irish whiskey. It had never been opened. Somebody must have stashed it there many years ago, and it was just what I needed. I picked it up and went back to my patient, and I opened the bottle and poured a little on his lips. He sputtered and spit. "You need to get a little of this in you if you can," I said. He nodded and let me know he understood. We tried again, and this time he swallowed a little more. His eyes began to open, and his color was closer to normal. "How you doing now?" I asked.
I think I might make it. I sure am thirsty, though."
I put the canteen to his lip, and he took a long swig. "What's your name?" I asked.
"Name's Gideon. Gideon Larson. That sorry Claymore took all the money and left me here."
"Don't worry about him right now. Just try to relax. I've got some jerky in my saddlebags. I'll get it and be right back. Don't go anyplace. By the way, my name's Jed."
"Like I could," he said.
I brought Beauty back to the hotel and then retrieved the jerky and went upstairs. "Here you go," I said. "If you can't chew it, just suck on it," as I handed it to him. "You need some nourishment of some kind. This is all I have." He put the piece in his mouth.
"Oh, that's good," he said. "What do you plan on doing with me?"
"Well, as soon as you're up to it, we're going back to Windy Butte. There's a young lady there that needs your help."
"What young lady could need my help?" he asked.
"Well, she's in jail for killing a man. Probably the man that you shot."
"But I didn't shoot nobody. I never even fired my weapon. George did all the shooting. No one was supposed to get hurt. Did you say she's in jail? That's something new. I ain't never heard of that. Why are they saying she killed him?
Because she's the one that shot you.
Well, I'll be. Shot by a girl. Now that's something to tell about in my old age.
Well, you won't have an old age if you don't get better, I said.
Reckon that's so. Maybe if I tell the sheriff it was Claymore done the shooting, they'd let her go.
Think they'll want to hear it from George personally, I said. You have any idea which way he headed?
He said something about that old miner shack back about 20 miles east of here. Told me when I felt up to it I could follow him. Wasn't that real nice of him?
What I think I'll do is go downstairs, build a fire, and make a jerky broth for you.
How's that sound? By the way, where's your horse? Oh, he's in the livery stable, where horses belong. If that broth will make me better, go to it.
I'll be back a little later, I said. Like I said before, don't go any place.
Yes, sir. I hear and obey.
I went downstairs to wander around and see what I could find. I walked down the alley between the buildings and happened upon a blackberry bush full of ripe blackberries. I picked enough to fill my hat and took them back around to the front. I decided to take them up to Gideon and then build a fire for the broth. I took them up to him and his eyes got big and round.
Blackberries, my favorite.
I pulled one of the other drawers out of the dresser and poured the berries into it, then pushed it where he could reach it. He was looking better every minute. Maybe he was going to survive. Be back later, I said, and I went downstairs and gathered wood to build a fire. I didn't have a pot to use to cook, so it was time for another look through the buildings. I started in the old general store, but it was cleaned out completely. I tried the cafe next, and there was a bent pot laying in the doorway. Just what I needed. Picked it up and went back to the front of the hotel, gathered some weeds and sticks, and built a fire. Poured about a cup of water in it and added a couple of pieces of jerky. I let it simmer a bit, then I started stirring. The jerky softened and began to thicken a little, and when I thought it was ready, I carried it back up to Gideon. He wasn't moving, so I went over and knelt down to listen to his breathing. It was extremely shallow. I shook him a little, and his eyes fluttered about halfway open.
I ain't feeling so good, Jed. I feel cold and very weak.
Oh, he had a fever, and I didn't know what to do. What did Orville do when that Indian boy had the fever? Just bathed his face and forehead with cool water. We were running short on water, and I sure hoped we had enough. I wet my bandana and wiped his forehead and face. He was mumbling something that I couldn't understand, so I knelt down closer to his face so I could hear.
Tell my ma I'm sorry, and I should have listened to her. I'm sorry for hurting her.
And those were his last words. He was gone, even though I thought he was getting better. I covered his face with his jacket. Gideon, I don't have time to bury you properly right now, but I promise I'll be back as soon as I catch George and take care of it. Chapter 12. I led Beauty to the livery stable and turned Gideon's horse loose. He wasn't going to need it anymore. The overcast sky had cleared completely, and I was heading into a cobalt blue sky that looked as if it was sliding up behind a sloping canyon. There was a small wooden bridge leading out of town to the east, and Beauty's hooves echoed as we crossed over it. There was nothing but barren landscape with rust-colored earth and a few green shrubs and cacti. I hoped I was heading in the right direction. How far did Gideon say it was to this miner shack? I thought he said it was about 15 miles east of here. Well, I was headed east, so it shouldn't take more than 3 hours to get there. Beauty was going along at a good clip, and after a while, I saw some smoke curling into the sky off to the left. I reined up, stood up in the stirrups to get a better look. I still couldn't see anything, so I turned Beauty and started slowly towards the smoke. There was this little incline straight ahead. I stopped Beauty, dismounted, and tied her reins to a small bush. Then I proceeded to walk slowly up the hill. When I was almost to the top, I dropped down on my stomach and crawled the rest of the way. I peeked over, and there was a ramshackled house, no more than a shack, with a small corral on the side that had one horse. He sure wasn't worried about getting caught, burning a fire like that. I crawled over the hill and into the bushes to the side. There was enough cover for me to stand, so I started towards the shack. Every once in a while, I would stop and listen. I thought I heard someone coughing, but I wasn't sure. So I continued on. As I got close enough, I heard the coughing sound again.
There was definitely someone inside. I passed by the corral, whispering to the horse to stay calm, and then I sneaked up next to the front door and listened. When he coughed again, I was going in. There it was. I kicked with all my might, and the door burst off the leather hinges. I had my pistol in my hand. "Hold it! Don't move!" I yelled. "Keep your hand away from your gun." He was a tall, thin man with greasy blonde hair that was parted in the middle. He was wearing worn denim trousers, a checkered shirt, and a leather vest. He lifted his unshaven face and looked at me. His bleary, red-rimmed eyes blinked twice quickly. His fear was showing. He looked at me, his hands shaking with fear, and he said, "Who are you? What do you want? I ain't done nothing." He raised a hand to cover his mouth as he coughed and wheezed. It sounded like consumption, and he had it bad. I didn't have to kill this man. He was already dead. "Just stand easy," I said. "Take your gun out and lay it on the table."
"Who are you?"
"I'm going to take you back to Windy Butte. There's something you have to do there."
"I ain't going back there," he said. "I ain't got nothing to do there."
And he coughed again and again. He reached as if to take his gun out and turned it towards me. The pistol went flying across the room as the bullet sliced his fingers off. When the realization of what just happened to him hit, he looked at me with his eyes glazed over and he slipped onto the floor, unconscious. I hurried over and wrapped his bandana around his broken and injured hand. If I could get the bleeding stopped, maybe we could travel back to Windy Butte. I went outside and built a fire, then stuck my knife blade in the flames, and while the blade was heating, I replaced the spent cartridge in my pistol. When it was hot enough, I took it back inside and cauterized the wound. Well, that would stop the bleeding, and when we got back to town, a doctor could fix it up better. Of course, his shooting with that hand had come to an end. I splashed water on his face, and he sputtered and woke up.
"You shot my finger off. Why'd you go and do that for?"
"Well, I told you to put your gun on the table. Bad things happen to bad boys when they don't obey. Now, let's get you up and ready to travel. We're in kind of a hurry."
"Told you I ain't going back,"
he said, and he coughed and wheezed again. "Then something else bad could happen to you," I said. "Now get up and let's go." He stood and stumbled out the door.
"Can't saddle my horse with this busted hand."
"Don't worry, I'll take care of it," I said. And as I was saddling his horse, I noticed the money was still in his saddlebags. He hadn't even bothered to take it inside with him. Some crooks sure aren't very smart. I saddled his horse, helped him into the saddle, and started leading him back to where I had Beauty staked out. I mounted up, and we were on our way. As we passed by the deserted town, he said,
"Maybe we ought to stop in here and check on my partner. I left him in there and told him I'd be back for him. He's hurt pretty bad."
"You're not only a thief," I said, "but you're also a liar. Gideon told me how you run off and left him to die. You had no intention of coming back."
"Gideon's dead. He died earlier today."
"I'm surely sorry to hear that," the man said. "He's a good kid. A little green, but other than that, he was all right. Did you know you killed an innocent bystander when you robbed that bank?"
"Shouldn't have been standing there. Figured if he didn't have enough sense to move out the way, he deserved to get shot."
Chapter 13. "When we get to town, I want you to say those exact words to the town council."
"Why should I?"
And he coughed again. "The reason is because I said that's what you're going to do, and the other reason is an innocent girl is going to be hanged if you don't."
"They ain't going to hang no girl. I ain't never heard of it ever happening."
"Well, it could very well happen if we don't get back to town pronto. Let's move a little faster." We pulled into Windy Butte a little after dusk. The streets were deserted, and I wondered where everybody was. The only building that was lit up was a saloon, so we stopped in front. There was a lot of commotion inside, a lot of shouting and cursing. I dismounted and looked at George, said, "You stay put till I come and get you, and don't try to run, because I will catch you, and I won't be happy." I walked inside, and the mayor was in the front of the room trying to gain control of the shouting. He looked up and saw me as I entered.
"Jed, am I glad to see you. These men want to hang Melody at first light. Can't say anything to change their mind."
"Maybe I can convince them," I said as I walked over next to the mayor, took out my pistol, and laid it on the bar. The room got so quiet you could hear a pin drop. "Most of you men know me from when I was here almost a year ago. You remember you were having that trouble with the Swearinger brothers, and nobody would step up and stop them, and that included your sheriff. I was a stranger just passing through, yet I stepped up and took care of that problem for you. Now, I would think that any appreciative people like you would want to repay me in some way. Am I correct? A few heads nodded in agreement. Others just stood there staring at me. Well, I think you should reconsider hanging an innocent girl. You see, Melody didn't kill that man. George Claymore, one of the robbers, killed him. How do you know that? Said one of the men. Melody's gun been fired. Yes, Melody shot and killed one of the bandits, and the other one shot your bystander. I still say, how do you know all this? He argued. Well, I went after the bandits. I located one of them in a deserted town east of here, and he died there. I followed the other one, this George Claymore, and found him in a deserted miner shack a little further east. Now, I've got him outside, and he's confessed to killing that man. Now, I would suggest that some of you men take him to see a doctor, and when the doctor's done with him, lock him up. In the meantime, some of you others go and let Melody out of jail, and I wouldn't be too awful slow about doing it. The mayor rushed across the room. Thank you so much, Jed. I knew that if anyone could do it, you could. I'm so grateful. If there's anything, and I mean anything, I can do for you, if it's within my power, I will do it. I think we need to do something for you first, I said. We need to persuade the good people of this town to put you back in office, but before that happens, let's go see Melody. Chapter 14. She was coming out of the jail with Chester, her husband, when she saw us. Then she dropped his hand, ran across the street, and jumped into her father's arms. She hugged him tightly and turned to me and said, Jed, how can I ever thank you? If you hadn't come when Papa asked you, I would have been hanged. And when you came, you didn't know about me being in jail. Thank you so much. Can I give you a hug? Absolutely, I said. She put her arms around my neck and squeezed hard. Then she whispered in my ear, If only I wasn't married. Oh, but you are, I said, and I slowly pushed her away. How about introducing me to your husband? Jed, this is Chester. Chester Wilkins, my husband. I suppose I wouldn't be married if it wasn't for you. What do you mean? I asked. Well, you remember when you were here before and I asked you to talk to my father about letting me have more freedom? Well, he did, and Chester's the result. Thank you for that also. I'm glad I could help. Now, I think that we all need to get a good night's rest. Tomorrow is going to be a very busy day. You'll come home with me, Jed, said the mayor. Now that Melody's married, we have an extra bedroom, and you're welcome to stay in it. Mrs. Madison will be glad to see you also. Melody, you and Chester need to stop by the house and let your mother know you're all right. All right, Papa. Good night, Jed. I'll see you tomorrow. See you later, Papa. Good night, Melody and Chester, I said. See you tomorrow. I told Mayor Madison I had to go and take my horse to the livery stable and that I would meet him at his house afterwards. I led the horse from the saloon to the livery stable. Glad to see you made it back in one piece, said Josh. Yes, there wasn't much to it, I said. This is a fine animal you let me have. She reminds me of my own horse. You sure I can't pay for the use of her? I've already told you I ain't going to charge you for nothing, and that's final. Anytime you need her, you come back. She'll be here for you. Well, thank you very much, I said. Now, I need to go to the mayor's house and get some rest. See you later, Josh. I started to knock on the door when it was pulled open. Mrs. Madison was standing there. I was watching for you, Jed. Please come in. I am so glad you came and helped save our baby girl. She reached up, pulled me down, and kissed me on the cheek. Would you care for something to drink or maybe something to eat? You probably haven't eaten, have you? Just a glass of water would be fine. Thank you, ma'am, I said. She left and returned with a tall glass of water. It sure tasted good. Beau has already gone up to bed. He wasn't feeling so good. The doctor told him to take it easy. He thinks he has a weak heart. With all this excitement going on, I'm very worried for him. Well, I sure am sorry to hear that, ma'am. He's a good man. I'm sure if he gets a good night's rest, he'll be better in the morning. I suppose you're ready to go to bed yourself, aren't you? Well, follow me, she said. I followed her up the stairs and down the hallway to the second door on the left. This is it here, she said, and she opened the door. If you need anything at all, I'll just be down the hall. Well, thank you, ma'am. Good night. Good night, Chad. I immediately knew This was Melody's room. It had pink curtains on the window, light purple bedspread, and a throw rug that was an embroidered butterfly pattern. It was definitely a girl's room. However, I wasn't going to let the color of the room affect my getting some rest. I removed my holster and hung it on the bedpost, then removed my clothes and poured water in the bowl, splashed water on my face and neck, dried with a towel, and lay down in the soft feather bed. I had barely said my prayers when my eyelids started getting heavy, so I cut the prayers a little short. The next thing I knew, I was hearing a rooster announcing to the neighborhood that it was morning. I got up, splashed water on my face, then dressed, picked up my gun, and went downstairs. I laid my gun on the table by the front door and walked into the dining room. The mayor was already sitting at the head of the table. "Morning, Jed. Trust you slept well," he said. "Slept like a baby," I said. "It's one of the softest beds I've ever had the pleasure of sleeping in. Thank you so much. How you feeling this morning, sir?" "Much better. Thank you for asking. What are your plans for the day?" asked the mayor. "First thing, I need to go out back to the outhouse." "Oh, you don't need to go out back. We have facilities right upstairs. It's in the room next to where you slept. Had it installed right after you left last year." "Thank you, sir. Now, if you'll excuse me." I hurried up the stairs and down the hall to the room next to where I had spent the night. I went in, and it was really something. I took care of business and was astonished when I pushed down on a little handle on the bowl. The water disappeared. I turned around and saw a 5-foot by 2-foot bathtub. It was white in color and a big improvement on the Saturday night tin tub I used at home. There was a smaller bowl attached to the wall with handles on it, much like the sink back home. I turned the handle and water came out. I washed my hands and face, dried with the towel hanging beside the sink, and I turned and took a final look, shook my head, and went downstairs. "Mighty proud of our dolphin toilet," said the mayor, "and we have the only bathing tub in town, other than the tubs at the barbershop." "It's very nice and convenient," I said. Mrs. Madison stuck her head in the room and said, "Breakfast is on its way." "I need to go back to that deserted town and get that young man's body," I said. "He needs a proper burial." "Would you like me to go with you?" asked the mayor. "No, sir. I think you should start some politicking this morning. We want to get you back in office as soon as we can." "Well, that sounds like a plan." "Good. Here's the breakfast," said the mayor. Scrambled eggs, bacon, fried potatoes, and hot black coffee. A man couldn't ask for a better meal. As soon as we ate, I told him I was going to rent a wagon and pick up Gideon's body. Chapter 15.
"No," argued Josh.
"Gonna charge you nothing for using this wagon. Now let's not fuss about it no more." "Just a little bit stubborn, aren't you?" I said. "You call it what you want," said Josh. "I call it helping my friends." I drove the wagon out to the deserted town and stopped in front of the saloon. Then I set the brake and climbed down. Was it only yesterday that I was here? Things looked a little different when it wasn't overcast, and you weren't trying not to get shot. It was probably a pretty little town in its heyday. I went upstairs and into the room where Gideon was, or at least where Gideon was supposed to be, but his body was gone. Now who and why would anyone want the dead body of an outlaw? I looked all around the room, then walked to the window and looked out into the street. I didn't see anything. Maybe I should have been more careful than I was, coming into town as if everything was all right. I walked back downstairs and went outside. Then I stepped behind the porch post. It wasn't much, but it afforded me a little bit of cover. I surveyed the street, both east and west. Nothing. I stepped down off the boardwalk, into the dusty street. Then I glanced quickly around the rooftops. I didn't see anything out of the ordinary. So I started walking east on Main Street, glancing down each alleyway and both sides of the street. Pow! The shot just barely missed my head. I threw myself to the ground and rolled over to the side of the road. My pistol was automatically in my hand. I scrunched up against the boardwalk as close as I could, and then I raised my head and tried to see where the shot originated. It could have been from any place. These old buildings are the perfect hiding place. I crawled to the alley between the two buildings. There were some crates strewn around, so it was a good place for me to gather my wits. I kept crawling until I was safely behind a large crate. I took a deep breath, trying to get my heart to slow down. My gut was also extremely tight and hurting from the pressure of almost getting hit. Who was this invisible culprit, and why was he shooting at me? Could there have been a third partner in the robbery? Well, that would explain everything. And how was I going to flush him out? I sure didn't relish the idea of being shot at without me knowing where the shots were coming from. I circled around behind the buildings and came in from the other end of town. That way, maybe I'd be able to spot him. I crawled behind the building, stood slowly, and started walking to the end of town. I reached the last building and snuck around the side. Then I looked around the corner and spotted movement in the livery stable. I stood extremely still, and there it was again. There was definitely someone in that building. I turned around and walked to the back of the building, thinking that if I could get far enough out of town, I could come up behind him and surprise him. That was going to be my best chance of getting him before he got me. I crouched down and headed way out around the town's boundaries. Then I came up behind the livery stable. I opened the back door as quietly as I could and went inside. The hayloft was in the front, over the front door, and I could clearly see his back. He was looking out the door of the loft, and he had a rifle in his hands, and I had my pistol cocked and ready. "Throw your gun out the door, and I won't shoot you," I said. I could see his body stiffen. I had indeed surprised him. He kneeled there for just a second, and then he threw his rifle out the door of the loft. "Put your hands on top of your head," I said, "and turn around slowly. My gun's pointed right at you, and I won't miss at this distance." He turned, and I saw his face, and it was like a bolt of lightning hit me. I staggered a little and almost dropped my gun. I was flabbergasted. There, looking down at me from the loft, was someone I never would have suspected. It was Chester Wilkins, Melody's husband.
"Chester, come on down here, and remember I've got you covered."
He climbed down the ladder and turned to face me.
"You don't have to do this, Jed. You let me go," he said. "No one will be the wiser."
"But I would know, Chester," I said. "You shouldn't have shot at me, and you would have probably been in the clear. Did you bury Gideon?"
"No, I just carried him out into the woods and left him. Not going to matter to him anyway."
"Everyone deserves a decent burial," I said. "You need to show me where you left him, and you and me will take him back to Windy Butte."
"You should really let me go. You're going to break Melody's heart if you do this," he said.
"I'm not the one who's going to break her heart. You did that when you joined up with outlaws. You were in on the robbery, weren't you?"
"I planned the whole thing," he said. "Everything would have been okay if Melody had shot Gideon. Her doing that got you involved, and then it was like a runaway freight train. There was no stopping unless I could get you out of the picture."
"What were you doing out here?" I said. "You didn't come out here to bury Gideon, so you'd have been all right if you just stayed in town."
"I was looking for the money. I didn't see it when you brought George back to town."
"Well, it's in his saddlebags in the livery stable," I said. "I was planning on giving it back to the bank soon as I got Gideon buried. Now, show me where you took Gideon's body." We walked a little way out into the woods, and he said, "Right over there, in that little gully." Sure enough, there he was. It was a good thing he had just taken him out here, because if it had been any longer, the animals would have desecrated the body. I brought a blanket with me to wrap up the body. "You jump down there and hand him up to me," I said.
"Got him. Now come on up here and help me carry him back to the wagon."
We carried him back to the wagon and carefully laid him in the back. There was a tarpaulin in the back, and I wrapped it around his body.
"Where's your horse?" I asked.
"It's on the outskirts of town. Didn't want to bring it to town in case there was somebody here. We'll get in the wagon. We'll go pick it up." He climbed up beside me. "I sure wish you'd reconsider and let me ride off. Promise I won't come back."
"You'd just ride away and not even consider your wife and her feelings?"
"Well, I care more about my own freedom than I care for my wife," he said. "You're really a piece of work. You know that?" I said.
"What do you mean?" he asked.
"Melody deserves more than what you can give her. She deserves a man that's honest and will own up to his shortcomings, even if you have to go to prison. She deserves a man like that."
"Well, that's easy for you to say," Chester said. "You're not looking at facing a judge and going to prison, maybe for a long time."
"Melody will wait. She loves you very much," I said. "She's a loyal person, and she will stand by her man, no matter what he does."
"Yeah, if I thought that was true, I'd be willing to turn myself in."
"You can take what I'm telling you to heart," I said. "She's a good woman."
"Okay," he said. "Let's go. I'll face my troubles head on.
Just hope you're right about everything." He tied his mount to the back of the wagon and said, "I'll ride up here with you if that's okay. I got some mighty serious thinking to do." He was very quiet on the ride to town, deep in thought, and I could only imagine what was running through his head. I drove the wagon up to the front of the jail. "All right, this is where you get off," I said. "Go on in the jail and into a cell. I'll take Gideon's body to the undertaker and go get Melody. We'll be back later." He climbed down from the wagon seat, then stopped and looked up at me. Tears were running down his face. "Thanks, Jed," he said. "I wish I could have gotten to know you better. I think you would have been a real good friend." "Not too late to be your friend, Chester," I said. "With a solicitor, you could get off with only a couple of years, maybe even less, if you had someone to vouch for you." He turned and disappeared inside the jail. Chapter 16. I drove the wagon to the undertaker's place of business, set the brake, climbed down, and walked inside. He was a slender man with black hair to his collar and a pointed goatee, and he was wearing a black sack coat over dark gray trousers. He looked to be around 50 years old and was nailing a coffin together. He looked up as I entered, then laid the hammer inside the coffin.
"Can I do for you, young man?"
"I got a body outside in the wagon," I said. "I'd like for him to get a decent burial."
"Ain't you that gunfighter that run the sheriff out of town?" he asked.
"I don't especially like to be called a gunfighter, but yes, I did convince the ex-sheriff that he would be better off if he left for other places. Now, how much to bury this young man? You just want a plain wood coffin, or do you want one of those store-bought ones?"
"I think a wood coffin would be fine. How much?"
"I'll think $15 to cover it."
"Well, how about $5, and be glad that you're getting that much."
"Ah, yes, I think that'll be satisfactory," the undertaker said. "Now show me to the body." I helped him carry the body into the building, paid him $5, and left. I told him I would be riding with him to Boot Hill since I didn't have a horse. Boot Hill was located about 2 miles out of town. "Don't leave without me," I said. "I could be a little late."
"Whatever you say, you're paying," he said.
I climbed up onto the wagon seat and proceeded to the livery stable. I wondered if I should ask George and Chester if they wanted to go. They claimed to be friends with Gideon.
"I'm mighty glad to see you come back in one piece," said Josh, when I got to the livery stable. "Was that Chester Wilkins riding in the wagon with you? Noticed you dropped him off at the jail."
"Chester's in a bit of trouble," I said. "I suppose I might as well tell you, since you'll find out soon enough. Chester was the mastermind behind the bank robbery. He was in the deserted town and tried to kill me. Brought him back to face up to what he's done."
"Well, I can't say I'm surprised," said Josh. "He's always been a little greedy. I told Frank McGuire, the bank owner, that he was making a mistake hiring the boy."
"Well, it's done now," I said. "I've got to go tell Melody and her father. Talk to you a little later, Josh. Thanks for the use of the wagon." I walked over to the Madison's house and knocked on the front door. Melody answered. "Oh, hello, Jed. Did you get all your business taken care of?"
"Yes," I said. "I picked up the robber's body and brought it to the undertaker.
But something else happened that you need to know about." "What could I possibly need to know about that robber, except that it was my bullet that killed him? But you know, I'm not sorry. He shouldn't have robbed that bank. If you break the law, you're taking a chance on getting killed," she said.
"Well, while I was there, someone took a shot at me," I said.
"Oh, my goodness, are you all right?"
"I'm fine, but the person who shot at me is Chester."
"Chester? You mean my Chester? You have to be wrong. Chester would never do anything like that. You've got to be wrong."
Tears were filling her eyes and running down her face.
"Sorry, Melody, but it was him. He's over in the jail right now. Come on, I'll take you to see him. Where's your father?"
"He's at his office," she cried.
"We'll stop by there on the way and let him know what's happening. I'm sure he'll want to join us to see Chester." We stopped by the mayor's office.
"Please come in, Jed. What are you doing here, Melody?"
"Chester's in jail, Papa."
"What do you mean, Chester's in jail?" the mayor said. "Why on earth would he be in jail?"
"He was behind the bank robbery," she said, "and he tried to shoot Jed."
"Oh, my. Well, let's go see him now."
We walked across the street to the jail, and when I opened the door, Chester was sitting at the desk with his feet propped up on top.
"Thought I told you to go in a cell," I said.
"All the cells are locked."
"What are you doing here, sweetheart? And you, Mr. Madison?"
Why'd you do it, darling? We didn't need the money enough for you to rob a bank.
Well, I thought if we had enough money, we could buy that little house at the end of Mulberry Street. You know, the one you said you liked so much, Chester said.
We were doing just fine where we're at. Oh, why, Chester, why?
Should have come to me, young man, said the mayor. I would have been more than happy to help my little girl and her husband. Just can't understand why you would do something like this. Well, now, as I look back on it, I don't know why either, Chester said. Jed said if I get a good lawyer, maybe I could get a break. You know of a good lawyer, Mr. Madison? Yes, there's a new lawyer in the next town. I'll have a man ride over and get him immediately. Don't you worry, son. We'll figure this out. Thank you, sir, said Chester. I really appreciate this. I'd do anything for my baby girl, said the mayor. And you are her choice for a husband.
And I married you for better or worse, said Melody. And of course I was hoping there wouldn't be any worse. Guess I was wrong. I love you, and I will be at your side the whole time.
Jed was right about you, Chester said. He said you were loyal and that you loved me.
Thank you, sweetheart.
I love you. Well, I think it would be best if you went into a cell until we could get you a lawyer or someone in authority releases you, I said, until a trial could be set. I thought I might mention I won't be pressing charges against you for shooting at me. Maybe the judge will take into account that you turned yourself in.
Well, I don't know what to say, said Chester. Thanks so much, Jed.
Jed, let you and I go talk to the town council about reinstating me as mayor, said the mayor. Then I will have the power to let Chester go home with Melody until the circuit judge comes to town. I believe that me being with the mayor when he approached the council convinced them that the right thing to do would be to reinstate him. It was official. He was Mayor Madison of Windy Butte, New Mexico Territory. His first official act as mayor was to release his son-in-law to the custody of his daughter, Melody Wilkins. Maybe everything would work out for them. Love is a powerful thing. It can cause the worst situations to work themselves out.
Chapter 17. I told them I was going by the undertaker to find out when he was going to bury Gideon.
I figured first thing in the morning, day after tomorrow, the undertaker said, before it gets too hot. You planning on being there?
I am, yes, I told him.
Let's say 7:30 at the cemetery on Boot Hill.
I'll be there, I said. Good day to you.
Good day to you, sir.
Well, what was I going to do now? The mayor said the circuit judge wouldn't come to town till the end of the month. By that time, Orville and Halfloaf should be here. I was sure looking forward to seeing them. I missed my friends. I was walking past the hotel when I heard someone groaning in the alley. I walked over, and there, all hunched up into a ball, was a young Mexican girl. She was probably about my age or a little younger. Her face was bruised and swollen, and she was in a lot of pain.
"Please don't hit me again," she said.
"Easy now. I'm not going to hurt you. Let me help you sit up." I leaned her up against the wall of the building. "Do you think you can walk if I help you?"
I don't think I can, she mumbled.
Let me try to lift you without hurting you.
All right.
I reached down and slipped my arms under her legs and back and lifted her up in my arms. She was a tiny thing, probably less than 5 feet tall and weighed maybe 100 pounds. We'll go right in here, I said. It's the hotel.
They won't let me in there, she groaned.
You let me worry about that. I carried her inside and the clerk started to say something. I gave him a look and said, keep quiet. Give me a room. Now, go fetch the doctor and bring him here quickly. He handed over a key and rushed past us to get the doctor. I glanced at the room number, then carried her upstairs into room 8 at the end of the hall. I laid her on the bed and helped her lean on the headboard. She couldn't seem to straighten out her body. I went over and poured a glass of water and wet the towel. Do you feel like drinking a little water? I asked. She tried, but couldn't, because she was in so much pain. I wiped at her face with a damp towel. Both of her eyes were swelled almost closed, and there were cuts all over her face, arms, and no telling what under her clothes. There was a knock at the door, and I walked over and let the doctor in. What do we have here? The doctor said. Looks like you had a little accident. Let me take a look. I'll be as easy as I can, but I do need to examine you. Hand me that bowl full of water, young man, and step back out of the way.
"I'll just wait outside the door," I said. "You call me if you need me." "All right," he said. "Just don't go far. I may need you to hold her down if it hurts too much. In fact, just stay where you are." He was poking and prodding, and she was groaning each time he touched her. As I looked on, he was washing the cuts and bruises, then dabbing some ointment on them. "I'm going to have to remove your garment to see what damage has been done to your body," the doctor said. She tried to lean forward, but couldn't. "You just try to relax," the doctor said, "and let me do all the work, okay?" He removed her clothing, and her body was black and blue, from top to bottom. Pushed on her ribs, and she almost screamed. "Got a couple of broken ribs. I'll wrap them up," the doc said. "Then maybe you can sit up a little bit better. You have any idea who did this to you?" She nodded in the affirmative. He looked at me as if to say, "This needs to be taken care of." I nodded to him that it would be. "That's about the best I can do for her," the doc said after he had finished treating her. "The laudanum I gave her should help her sleep through the night. You probably need to stay with her, though, in case she wakes. If she does, give her another half spoon of the laudanum. No more than that. I'll check back on her tomorrow around 10 o'clock. "All right, doctor," I said. "How much do I owe you?" "Well, we'll settle up when she's up and walking around. You know, she didn't need to go back to that way of life. She's a young, pretty girl. Man could do worse than her to settle down with." "Thank you," I said. "I'll see you tomorrow. Good night." "Good night, son," said the doctor as he closed the door behind him. I pulled the chair up close to the bed and sat watching her sleep. I could tell she was beautiful under all those bruises. She was restless as she slept, and she kept mumbling. "Please stop. Don't hit me again. Please," she said over and over. I wanted to comfort her in some way, but I was afraid to touch her. She might think I was trying to hurt her more. I would have to wait until she woke and could see me through those swollen eyes. I dozed as I sat beside her bed. The next thing I knew, it was morning. I opened my eyes and looked at her, and she was laying there looking at me. "How you doing this morning, sunshine?" I asked. She tried to smile, but she couldn't. "My name is Pepper Ramirez, but it's just plain Pepper for almost 3 years now. Papa named me Pepper because he said I was his little hot tamale. What's your name?"
"I'm Jedediah Jenkins, Jed to my friends, and you are a friend. At least, I hope we can be friends."
"After what you did for me, I will be your friend forever, and I won't charge you if you come to visit me at Flora's place."
"Now that's something we need to discuss when you're feeling better," I said. "Now, you need more rest. Let me give you some of the medicine that the doctor left for you." I poured half a spoonful, and she swallowed it down.
"Oh, that is bitter. Can I have some water?"
I helped her take a swallow of water. "Now I need to leave," I said. "I have something to take care of."
"I should have known better than to go outside with that guy. Miss Flora has always told me to stay in the house. I didn't think. And look at me now. Do you think I'll have a scar?"
"I don't think it's that bad," I said. "I know it hurts, but I think the worst is over. All you have to do now is rest and get better. Try to sleep now. I'll be back a little later.
Oh, please don't leave me alone."
"Well, I'll stay here till you fall asleep," I said. "Then I have something I need to do. I'll be back, I promise." As soon as she was sleeping, I went downstairs and told the clerk not to let anyone disturb the young lady in room 8 and not to tell anyone about this. "Yes, sir," he said. "Whatever you say."
Chapter 18. I walked into the mayor's office hoping he would be there, and he was, so I walked in, sat down in front of his desk.
"Morning, Jed. How are you? We missed you when you didn't return last night."
"Oh, I spent the night at the hotel," I said.
"Well, you're more than welcome to stay at our house long as you want," the mayor said.
"I understand," I said, "but circumstances deemed I spend the night at the hotel. Can you tell me about Miss Flora's place?"
"Well, I didn't think a nice young man such as yourself was interested in such a place," the mayor said.
"Please indulge me," I said. "I have my reasons for wanting to know."
"Well," said the mayor, "Miss Flora came to town, I guess it was about 6 years ago. She had enough money to buy one of the businesses in town, so she opened up a house of ill repute. Then about a year later, Mr. Myers, the founder of the town, died and left her that big house on Poplar Street where she's at now. I don't know what relationship she had with him, but whatever it was very profitable to her. I understand she runs an honest house, never causes any trouble. It's about all I know, since I don't frequent such places myself. May I ask why you're asking about Flora's?"
Well, I'll let you know later, I said. Right now I need to go and talk to her. Good day to you, sir. Walked down to the end of the street, turned right, and there, at the end of Poplar Street, was a big two-story clapboard house. It had been painted recently and looked like a new building. I opened the little gate, walked up to the front door, and there was a brass knocker and a sliding peephole. I knocked three times, but nothing. I knocked again and again, and finally heard someone holler, "We're closed. Come back tonight." I knocked again, and the door opened just enough for a woman to peer out. "I told you we're closed, cowboy. Now come back tonight." "Are you Miss Flora?" I asked. "Might be. Who's asking?" "Do you know a young girl named Pepper?" "Yes, but she won't be available till tonight." "Is she here now?" I asked. "Of course she's here. Where else would she be?" "Perhaps you should check her room," I said, "because I know for a fact that a girl named Pepper is in a bed at the hotel at this very moment. I'll wait here while you check." She was back almost instantly. "She's not there. You say she's at the hotel? What's she doing there? Did you take her there?" "Yes, I found her in the alley beside the hotel," I said. "She was hurt real bad, so I took her to the hotel and called the doctor." "Is she going to be all right? There's a bunch of drovers coming in tonight, and Pepper is one of their favorites." "Pepper won't be coming tonight, or any other night, if I have anything to say about it. She's hurt really bad, and it's going to be a while before she can get out of bed. I would think you'd be more concerned for her health than your business." "Listen, cowboy, I don't know who you think you are, but you can't come in here and talk to me like this." "Tell you who I am," I said, "and you would be obliged to remember. I'm the gunfighter that ran the crooked sheriff out of town. I'm the gunfighter that chased down the bank robbers and brought one of them back for justice. And lastly, I'm a friend of Pepper's, and I will protect her until she is able to fend for herself. Good day to you, ma'am." I left her standing in the doorway, stuttering and spewing fire from her bloodshot eyes. I went back to the mayor's office, walked in, and sat down. "Did you talk to her?" said the mayor. "Yes, we had a pleasant conversation," I said. "There's something else I want to ask you, mayor. How are Jackson Hadley and his family doing?" "Oh, Hadley and his family left town shortly after you were here," the mayor said. "Felt the town wouldn't forgive him for the time he spent as sheriff. He was a little hard on some of the folks. Last I heard, he was very content in a little settlement west of here called Olive Tree. I'm just a little ashamed of the way I treated him. In fact, I've turned over a new leaf, and suppose you're responsible for that, Jed. Thank you." "Well, I'm mighty glad to hear that, sir," I said. "How about you and me get some dinner? Is there a good eating establishment around here?" "Yes, indeed," said the mayor. "I know just the place, if you'll follow me." We left the office, and I followed him. He stopped in front of his house and said, "This is it. Mrs. Madison is the best cook in four counties. She'll be happy to see you. Come on in." I unfastened my holster just inside the door and laid my gun on the table there. "My, I wasn't expecting you, Jed, but you're very welcome. I missed you last night." "Yes, ma'am," I said. "I had some pressing business I had to attend to. I hope I'm not putting you out by being here. I can always go to the cafe." "Nonsense. Come in and sit. I'll have something fixed in a jiffy. You know where to wash up, don't you?" The mayor and I both went into the little room off the kitchen to wash up. We both washed, dried, and went back to the dining room. Mrs. Madison already had the table filled with delectable food. I didn't think food at the cafe would have been this good. "Thanks so much for allowing me to join you," I said. "It all looks delicious." "You're very welcome. Any time, Jed. Why, we consider you part of our family. Please, would you say grace?" I asked God to bless this meal and this fine family. I also asked him to guide us in the days ahead as they were going to be trying. I asked for him to give strength to Melody and Chester because they were facing a difficult time. The meal was really very good and quite filling. "Thank you, ma'am," I said when I was finished up. "That was very good. Now, if you'll excuse me for eating and running, but I have someplace I have to be. Thank you again, and good day." Chapter 19. I picked up my gun on the way out and strapped it around my waist as I walked to the hotel. "Has anyone been here asking about the girl?" I asked the clerk. "Miss Flora was here, but I refused to tell her what room the girl was in. She said some very bad things about my mother, then left in a huff," said the clerk. "You did very well," I said. "Add a generous tip to the bill and keep doing what you've been doing. I appreciate it a lot." I nodded to him and walked up the stairs to room number 8. Then I used the key I had in my pocket to unlock the door. I pushed it open and went inside, and Pepper was sitting up in bed, looking very much better.
"How you feeling today?" I asked. "Any better? You need some more medicine?" "Well, I'm hungry more than anything else. Yes, I'm feeling much better, although I still hurt. How about something to eat? And I don't mean that stuff you feed sick people. I need a big steak and potatoes and a big glass of milk. Can you help me with that?" "You said your name was Tad or Fred?"
"I'm Jed, and yes, I can get you something to eat. You wait right here."
"I don't think I can go any place just yet, but soon. Now, if you would, please hurry with that grub."
"Be right back," I said, went downstairs and asked the clerk to get some food, bring it to the room. I explained exactly what Pepper wanted.
"Yes, sir," said the clerk. "Be back as soon as they can cook up a steak." I went back upstairs and sat in the chair next to the bed. "You feel up to telling me about yourself?"
"Well, I reckon," she said. "You already know my name, Pepper Ramirez. I was the baby girl of 6 kids. My daddy moved us from Old Mexico to here. He said this New Mexico is going to be good for us. He bought a little homestead just south of town. When I was 15, a group of Comancheros came to our home. I ran out the back door and hid in the woods, and I was the only one to escape that horrible night. My whole family was butchered and burned in our house. I was lying in a field of clovers when these women found me. They brought me back to town, and that was when I found out they were prostitutes. I didn't have any family or any place to go, so I stayed and became a prostitute. I didn't particularly like it, but I accepted it as my lot in life. I had a roof over my head, a bed to sleep in, and something to eat each day. All I had to do was pretend to enjoy it. I should have known better than to go outside with that guy. Madame Flora always told us to stay in the house. I didn't think, and look at me now."
"Well, all of these injuries will heal," I said. "You'll barely notice them. There might be a little scar, but it'll fade with time. Now, what can you tell me about the man who did this to you?"
"He said he was a drover, on a cattle drive just outside of town. He didn't say much after he told me that. When he was through with me, he asked if I would go outside and look at the moon and stars, and like a fool, I agreed. We had barely gotten outside when he hit me, and kept hitting me. I begged for him to stop, but he just kept hitting and kicking me when I fell to the ground. At least I think I scratched him across his face before I passed out. Maybe he'll have a scar just like me. That would be something, wouldn't it? Anyway, I passed out, and when I came to, he was gone. I crawled around on the ground, and it took me almost all night to get to where you found me. Thank you for finding me."
There was a knock on the door, and a voice from the other side said, "Food's here. May I enter?"
"Come on in," I said. The clerk was carrying a covered tray, which smelled very good.
"Oh, my, that smells so good. Please, set it right here on my lap. Thank you."
The clerk looked at her, and I could see pity in his face. "Please enjoy your meal. If I can be of further assistance, please call me," he said. I think he was smitten with Pepper. I had seen that look before. In fact, I probably had that look myself a time or two. Maybe when she was all healed, we'd be able to get these two together. "I'm going to be gone for a couple of days," I said to the clerk. "I want you to check on this young lady more than once a day. Take care of her like she was your own kin. You think you could do that for me?"
"Yes, sir," said the clerk. "I'll be glad to watch out for the young lady. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go back downstairs. Night to you, ma'am. Hope you feel better."
"Do you have to leave me here with that boy to look out for me?" asked Pepper.
"Well, I have to leave town for a while, and he's a little more than just a boy, if you could see with two good eyes."
"Okay," she said. "When are you coming back?"
"Like I said, at least a couple of days. You just stay in bed till you feel up to getting out. If you do get up, please remain in this room. This will be the first place I come when I return. Take care and get better. That's an order."
"Yes, Jed," she said.
Chapter 20. I went to the livery stable and didn't see Josh any place. I hollered for him, and he came out from behind the tack room door.
"Ah, you Jed. How you doing? I'll take a little cat nap in the tack room. Do for you."
"You know anything about a cattle drive camped outside town any place?"
"Yeah, camped in a draw just west of town, probably 15 miles out. You planning on paying them a visit, are you?"
"I was planning that all right. Can I have Beauty?"
"Now, let's don't go through this again," said Jess. "I told you you can have Beauty any time you want her. If I'm not here, you just go ahead and take her. How's that sound?"
"Well, thanks, Josh," I said. "You're a true friend. See you later." I saddled Beauty and rode out of town towards the place where the cattle drive was supposed to be. Looked like it was going to be dark before I got there, so I sure hoped I could settle this without too much fuss. Took about 2 hours at a gallop with Beauty. I saw their campfire from a distance. When I got up close enough, I called out, "Yo, in the camp, friendly coming in." "Right on in easy-like, so as I can see your hands," a voice said. I raised my hands and rode into the camp, then sat until I was told I could dismount. "I'm trail boss of this outfit. Go ahead and get down, state your business. Pour yourself a cup of joe while you explain what you're doing here." He was medium-sized, with a sweat-stained felt hat, leather chaps over dungarees, and a checkered shirt. He had a round, unshaven face, intense brown eyes, and extremely large hands. His looking at me caused me to pause before I spoke. "Well, I don't care for any coffee, but thanks," I said. "I'm from Windy Butte, and I was wondering if any of you fellas was there last night." "Nobody from here went to town," he said. "Men had strict orders to stay away till Saturday night." "Why are you asking?" "Well, there was a young lady hurt very badly by a drover from this outfit." "I done told you. Nobody left camp last night. Now you better mount up and get." I reached down and removed the leather tie-down on the hammer of my pistol. He noticed what I did and stood straight up. "Believe you're outnumbered if you take a look around," he said. "But I'll just be shooting one of you," I said. "And that one is you." And I looked at him. He was a cowboy, but he wasn't a gunman. "Now hold on, we don't need no shooting. What'll it take to satisfy you?" he asked. "Telling you, none of my boys went to town last night." "One of them will have scratches on his face," I said. "If none of your boys have those scratches, all right out, no harm done." "Gather round, boys, show your faces to this hombre." They all lined up behind the fire so I could see their faces clearly. "Well, you happy?" he called. "Is this all your men?" I asked. "Sure it is, except Will and Johnson. They're riding night herd. Ed, you and Hoppy ride out until Will and Johnson come to camp." "Man won't accept a cup of coffee when it's offered. It's considered an insult where I come from," the trail boss said. "Where is it you come from?" I asked. "We hail from Texas, a ranch called Rock Creek Ranch, just south of Jupiter, Texas." "Are these Kaplan's cattle?" I asked. "Well, yeah, you know him?" asked the trail boss. "We met in a stagecoach one time. You enjoy working for him?" "Well, ain't got much choice. Cattle drives are getting mighty scarce. I was lucky to pull this herd together. Kaplan's just one owner who has cattle here." "Where are you from? Is that a little Texas I hear in your voice?" "Well, I've been there," I said. "Here comes those night riders. Take a look." The two riders rode into camp. "Need something, boss?" one of them asked. When they dismounted and turned around, you could clearly see the scratches on one of their faces. "You went to town after I gave you strict orders to stay in camp," the trail boss said. "It was just a little time for me to have a woman," the drover said. "You know it's been a long drive, and I didn't get into town at our last stop. No harm done, right?" The trail boss looked at him and said, "Well, this young man here would disagree with you about that, Will, and you're fired. Cookie, get the money box and pay him off. He no longer works for us. He's all yours, cowboy. Do what needs to be done. He deserves anything you give him." "Toss your weapon to me," I said. "Mount up. Come with me. Will, is it?"
"Well, I ain't going no place with you. Who are you, anyway?"
"Well, you might say I'm the avenging angel that's taken you back to town. You're going to stand trial for assaulting and almost killing a pretty young girl."
"She's just a whore," the drover said. "Besides, she enjoyed everything I gave her. All whores deserve that. It's part of their business." "Give me your gun and mount up," I said, "and I won't tell you again." And I rested my hand on the handle of my gun.
He was tall, 6'3", with short blonde hair and pale blue eyes, and he was wearing his gun low and tied down. Didn't look like the average cowpuncher. "Better hand over that hog leg so you won't get any ideas," I said. I could see in his eyes that he was debating whether to oblige me or draw on me.
"All right, but they ain't a judge in any county that'll convict me for beating a whore."
"Well, if he doesn't, then you'll have to face me, and the result won't be good. Now, your gun. Mount up and let's ride," I said. He took out his pistol and tossed it to me. I stuck it in my belt. I was real glad he gave up. If gunplay had started here in this camp full of Texans, I wasn't sure how many might be friends of his. There was no way I would have come out of it alive had that happened. I replaced the leather tie-down on the hammer of my gun. He mounted, as did I, and then I nodded to the trail boss and we headed to town. We arrived just before midnight and rode straight to the jail.
Get down. Let's go inside. There's a cell waiting for you. When we got inside, I lit a lamp and George Claymore asked, "You bring some company for me? Could sure use somebody to jaw with." I unlocked the cell next to George and said, "All right, well, inside." He slumbered into the cell, and I closed the door and turned the key in the lock. "Sit tight. Someone will bring you breakfast in the morning," I said. "Yeah, the food ain't half bad," said George. "Better than a lot of the food I've had in places like this. They take real good care of you. They even got a doctor for me. And my coughing has almost stopped."
Chapter 21. I took Beauty back to the livery stable, removed the saddle and brushed her a little, then put her in a stall and fed her a little oats. Walked back to the hotel, and when I entered, the clerk was leaning on the desk, fast asleep. I reached over, tapped him on the shoulder. He was small in stature, and his hair was greased and parted in the middle. He looked younger than he was, and was always impeccably dressed and very personable. "Oh, it's you," he said. "I was just resting my eyes. I'm glad to see you back. Pepper's doing fine. You know, she's a very special girl." "Yes, I'm glad you noticed that," I said. "I don't want to disturb her tonight, so I need a room for myself, preferably next to her room." "Yes, sir. Room 7's right this side of her room. Do you need anything else?" he said. "Nope, that'll take care of it. What's your name?" "Mine's Jed." "Oscar. Oscar Jones, at your service. Glad to make your acquaintance, Jed." "You know, you would rest better if you'd lie down," I said. "Oh, I've got a bed in the back here. I just didn't get up and go for it." "Well, good night, Oscar." And I took the key for room 7 and went upstairs and slapped a little water on my face and lay down with all my clothes on. "Lord, I'm afraid my prayers are going to be a little short again tonight. I prayed about all the things that had happened today," and then closed my eyes. Chapter 22. The next morning, I went to see how Pepper was doing. It's amazing how God made our bodies with the ability to heal when we were hurt. She was looking a whole lot better, but she was still sleeping, so I closed the door quietly and went downstairs. Oscar was wide awake. "Morning, Jed. Hope you slept well." "Good morning to you, Oscar," I said. "Yes, I did sleep well. Can you tell me where you got Pepper's meal the other night?" "Well, yes, of course. There's a cafe just over on Market Street. You can cut through the alley and come out on Market. Then 3 buildings down, cross the street. Flanagan's Cafe is the name of the place." "Thank you. Have you eaten yet?" I asked. "Oh, yes, I ate soon as they opened up. I do, however, have to go pick up breakfast for Pepper. I'll walk with you, if you don't mind." "Don't mind in the least," I said. "Lead the way." We walked through the alley and across the street, up to the cafe. "After you, Jed," he said as he opened the door for me. I walked in, took the table to the right. Oscar went over to the register and said something to the woman there, then came back and sat down. "I have to wait till I get Pepper's meals ready. You don't mind if I sit and we visit, do you?" "Oh, don't mind at all," I said. "Here comes the waitress. Let me order, and I would like to know all about you, too." I ordered 4 eggs, fried potatoes, and a pot of coffee. "Now, how long have you worked at the hotel?" I asked, "and how come you're working there?" "Well, I didn't have a lot of choice," he said. "My father owns a hotel, and when I got back from business school in Forester, Illinois, father was ill. It was my responsibility to take over for him. Doesn't look as though he has much longer to live, so I guess it'll be my hotel then." "Well, I'm sorry to hear about your father," I said. "I hope he'll recover." "Not much chance of that. Doctor gives him 6 months. Here she comes with your meal, and Pepper's also. Talk to you later," he said. "So long, Oscar." The breakfast was very good, but not as good as Mrs. Madison's. I paid, left the cafe, and walked back through the alley and across the street to the undertaker's. He had the coffin loaded in a wagon and was sitting in the seat. Chapter 23.
"Oh, I was just fixing to leave," the undertaker said as I approached, and I looked up at him. Then he added, "Well, just as soon as you got here is what I meant to say."
"Well, drive over by the jail. We might have 2 more passengers," I said.
"Who on earth set the jail be going with us?" he said.
2 friends of the deceased, I think. Just drive to the jail." He pulled in front of the jail, and I jumped down and went inside. George was lying on his bunk singing songs while Will was sulking in the corner of his cell.
"I'm glad to see you boys getting along so well," I said. "Would you care to attend the burying of Gideon?"
"Sure,"
said George. Anything to get out of this cell for a little while.
Well, that doesn't sound like you care about seeing Gideon put to rest.
I care, but I also want to get out of here, said George.
You want to go with us, Will? I asked.
He turned his back to me.
I unlocked George's cell and said, okay, outside, get in the wagon, watching you carefully so don't try anything.
We walked outside, climbed up into the wagon. I sat with the undertaker, and they sat in the back with the coffin. It was a bumpy ride to the cemetery. When we arrived, I climbed down and helped the undertaker carry the coffin to where he wanted it.
This way, gentlemen, he said.
The grave was already dug. We set it down right next to the grave. He had ropes laid out so we could lower the coffin into the grave.
You got any last words? He asked.
I said, do you boys want to say something about your friend?
No, you go ahead, Will said.
Well, please bow your heads. Dear Heavenly Father, we commit this body into the earth from whence it came, to be resurrected at the second coming of the Lord. We know that Gideon accepted Christ as his Savior just before he died, and today his soul is in heaven with you. Amen. We lowered the coffin into the grave, tossed the ropes in on top of it, and proceeded to shovel in dirt. When we were finished, George pleaded with me to let him go.
Just look the other way, he said, and when you look back, I'll be gone.
George, you know you've got to stand trial, not only for bank robbery, but for shooting that innocent bystander.
You're a hard man, Jed Jenkins.
Well, I agree with that.
All right, let's head back to town.
We all got into the wagon, went back to town. Mr. Whitaker stopped in front of the jail. I climbed down and said, George, you go on in and go to your respected cell. I'll be back to check on you later. He climbed down from the wagon, looking dejected, and walked inside. It was a nice burying, I told the undertaker. Thank you for doing it.
My pleasure, sir. Let me know if I can assist you any more. Good day.
And he drove off.
Chapter 24. I walked back to the hotel to check on Pepper and Oscar. When I got there, Oscar wasn't behind the desk. I reached and retrieved the key to my room and noticed that the key to Pepper's room was missing. I walked up the stairs and stopped in front of room 8. There was laughter coming from the room, so I turned the doorknob and stepped inside. Oscar was sitting next to Pepper's bed, holding her hand. They were enjoying one another's company a lot.
Wow, Jed! He released her hand and stood up. I'm just visiting with Pepper. She's here all day without anyone to talk to.
Well, as long as Pepper doesn't mind, neither do I said.
You two seem to be hitting it off very well. You like this young man, Pepper?
She blushed and said, I think I like him too much. Then she looked up at him and smiled.
Well, I need to get back downstairs, Oscar said.
Good day, Jed. I'll see you a little later, Pepper.
I looked at Pepper and said, I wanted you to know I have the man who did this awful thing to you locked in jail. He'll be standing trial as soon as the circuit judge gets here.
Well, thank you so much for your help. I don't know what I would have done if you hadn't come along when you did.
Looks like you and Oscar might turn into something serious. Then you wouldn't have to return to Miss Flora's.
That would really be something, she said. Make me a respectable lady. But I don't think his father would approve of me. He told me a lot about him and how he's very prejudiced against anyone who isn't white.
Well, there's one thing you need to realize. You're not marrying his father. If Oscar cares for you, I don't think he'll let his father dictate to him who he can keep company with. You just keep thinking pleasant thoughts. It could happen.
Now that her bruises were healing, I could see better how pretty she was. She was tiny, not quite 5 feet tall, and had short, raven, black hair, a heart-shaped face, and piercing black eyes. She was very confident for such a young age. I could see why her daddy called her his little hot tamale. She would be a very good catch for the right young man, and I'm hoping that young man is Oscar.
I have some things I have to take care of, I said to her. I'll be back a little later. I don't think you'll get too lonely with Oscar checking on you.
Don't tease me, she said. I really like him.
Bye, I said. And as I was walking out the door, Oscar called.
Jed, you got a minute?
Sure, I said. What can I do for you?
I wanted to see what you think about something. I would like to ask Pepper to marry me. She would be a lot of help to me in the hotel.
Do you think she would marry me?
Well, what's your father going to say about all this?
Well, I'm certain he won't like it, Oscar said, but I'm a grown man and old enough to make my own decisions. Besides, he won't be marrying her, I will.
I believe she will gladly accept your proposal, I said.
Well, thanks so much for insisting that I give her a room when you brought her here.
Well, you're more than welcome, I said. I wish you and Pepper
all the happiness in the world. Chapter 25. I left and I was walking back to the mayor's office when I heard a commotion in the alley. I proceeded to walk around the saloon where I heard the noise, and there were two men struggling with one another. One was just a little guy, but he was holding his own against a much larger man. They were both dressed like drovers. I stepped up about 4 feet from them and hollered for them to stop. Apparently, they were too busy wrestling because they didn't hear me. I removed my pistol and fired into the air, and they jumped apart as if something jerked them by the collar. They both turned their heads and blinked at me. "Why'd you do that? We wasn't hurting nobody." "Well, it looked like you were hurting each other," I said, so I stopped it. "Oh, we always fight like this. Every time we come to town, we don't hurt nobody. If Sid wins, I have to buy the drinks. If I win, he buys. Now we're going to have to start this all over because you stopped us." As I replaced the bullet in my gun, I said, "Well, I'm mighty sorry for butting in. Tell you what, why not let me pay for your entertainment for the night? That is, after the saloon opens." "Well, that sounds like a real good deal. How much you figure to give us for our entertainment? Does that include a visit to Miss Flora's for the both of us?" "Well, how much do you normally spend on these excursions?" I asked. "These what?" "How much do you spend when you come to town?" I said. "Maybe $15 a piece. Is that too much?" "Well, how about 10 each? Don't suppose I could talk you out of this expedition?" "You sure talk funny," one of them said. "What's expedi—" "Would you consider and change your plans for the evening?" I interrupted. "Just have a good meal over at the cafe." "Not a chance. We've been doing this for years, ever since we met in the first cattle drive. No, sir, it's a—" "What's that big word?" "Oh, yeah, it's a tradition with us." "All right, boys. Well, here's 10 apiece. Be careful. I'm afraid one of these days somebody's going to get hurt." "Well, thanks, mister. Ain't nobody going to get hurt. So long." Chapter 26. I needed to go to the bank to get some money transferred from my account in Angel's Falls. After that, I was going to visit Josh at the livery stable.
"How much longer before your friends arrive, do you think?" asked Josh.
"Well, it could be any day now. I sure miss them," I said.
"Yeah, friends is a good thing to have, especially close friends."
"Well, these are my family, ever since my pa was killed," I said. "They're very special to me."
"Looky here, that's the mayor. I reckon he's looking for you."
I stood and nodded to him, said, "How can I help you, sir?" "Well, I've been looking for you all over town," the mayor said. "I need you to come and talk to Chester."
"All right. Well, I'll see you a little later, Josh."
"Sure thing." We walked over to Melody and Chester's room at the hotel, and I could hear the shouting from the lobby.
"They've been going at it for about a half an hour," said Oscar. "Don't know what to do. Sure glad you're here."
I told the mayor to stay in the lobby, then I took the stairs two at a time. I didn't need the room number. I could hear them fussing. I didn't bother to knock, just turned the doorknob and walked in. They both stopped and looked at me.
"Oh, Jed, I'm so glad you're here. Chester is being unreasonable," Melody said. "He says he doesn't want to work for my father."
"Chester, calm down. Now please sit down and listen. Mr. McGuire has already said you won't be working at the bank any longer. It would look very good for you at your trial if you had a good job. I believe working for Melody's father would be just what the judge needs to hear. You do realize that you could go to jail for a very long time."
"Well, I guess I just wasn't thinking about that," Chester said. "I just don't want to be beholden to her father."
"Well, I don't believe he would expect any more from you than he did from Theodore. After all, you are part of his family now. I know for a fact that he wants you to help him. Maybe one day you could even be mayor. Well, that is, if we can convince the judge that you're a good citizen, one with a good job, family, and good friends."
"Well, you sure make a lot of sense," he said. "I'll take the job. Thanks, Jed. You're a true friend."
"Okay, now you two kiss and make up. You know fussing and fighting doesn't do a thing but get you upset. I'll leave you two alone to make peace."
"So long, Jed," Chester said. "Thanks again." I left and went past Pepper's room, and there was a lot of talking and laughing behind the door. I didn't disturb them. I would see them later, and I went back downstairs and told the mayor the results of my visit. "I believe everything will be all right now," I said, "until they have another disagreement." "He did say he would come to work for you." The mayor said, "Well, thank you so much, Jed. I sure wish you were a permanent part of our community."
Well, maybe someday, sir. Maybe someday. Well, don't tell Melody and Chester, but I'm going to build them a small house on that property that Theodore inherited from our grandfather. If he has to go to prison, Melody still needs a place to live. Well, that sounds like a wonderful plan, I said. As far as Chester going to prison, well, let's think positive. I'm going to leave now. If you need me for anything, I'll either be at the livery stable or here at the hotel. Chapter 27. I spent the next few days visiting with Josh at the livery stable. I also spent time with Pepper and Oscar. I don't think I ever saw a sweeter and happier couple. Pepper was up and about and already helping out at the hotel, cleaning rooms and making beds. Oscar's father was on his deathbed. I knew Oscar cared for him, but he didn't let his father's illness affect his relationship with Pepper. They were planning for their wedding to take place as soon as all the trials were over. The judge came to town and the trials were held on Friday morning. Chester's trial was first, and I testified on his behalf, telling how he turned himself in. I didn't mention that he had shot at me, and the judge let him off easy. Of course, he had to resign from his bank job, but that worked out fine because Mayor Madison wanted him to work at his office doing what Theodore used to do. It didn't hurt that he was married to Melody, the mayor's only daughter. Chester got 5 years probation. Will's trial was next. He argued that she was just a whore and deserved what she got. After the doctor and I testified, the judge said, "Miss Ramirez is a human being and did not deserve what you did to her. After hearing all the evidence and because of the severity of the injuries, William Kenneth Rafferty, I sentence you to 2 years in the territorial prison." Will was spitting mad. "She ain't nothing but a whore. You can't lock me up for hitting a whore. Ain't right." With an attitude like that, he was going to have a hard time in prison. George was sentenced to hang. He had no remorse about killing that innocent bystander. His consumption had gotten worse, and the doctor said he only had about 9 months to live, but it had no effect on the judge's decision. He said the sentence would stand. George Claymore was set to hang on Saturday morning at sunrise. Folks traveled from near and far for the hanging. Some came because they'd never seen a hanging, and some out of curiosity. Others were there because they craved excitement. People were sometimes a sorry lot. They built the scaffold behind the jail, and I wondered how George felt, hearing the hammering and pounding the nails, knowing that they were for him. I went to talk to him the day before he was to hang, and asked him about his relationship with the Lord. "Do you know if you will go to heaven when you die?" I asked. "I'd bust heaven wide open if I tried to get in," he said. "Well, you're mistaken, George. People of all kinds are welcome in heaven, if you have the key." "What key? I ain't never heard about no key to heaven. I've done too many bad things to go to heaven. Hurt too many people. Ain't no way God's gonna let me in." "Well, God provided a way to get in, George. He said in the Bible that we all deserve to be condemned to eternal death. But his son Jesus died for us, and all we have to do is accept that." "Accept what?" "Let Jesus take your place. Let him take that eternal death in your place. Ask God to forgive you for all your sins and tell him to let Jesus take your place. Ask Jesus to come into your heart, and after tomorrow, you will be in heaven with God." "Well, you make it sound so easy," he said. "Well, it is easy. God made it easy. Just ask his forgiveness and ask Jesus to come into your heart. It's that easy. If you would like for me to pray with you, I would be happy to do that." "Okay, tell me what to say." "I can tell you, George, but the words have to be from you, and you have to mean them. Repeat these words. Dear Lord, I admit I've done a lot of bad things. I ask you now to forgive me and let Jesus come into my heart. Amen." George confessed his sins, and on the day before his death, his name was written in the Lamb's Book of Life. It's a wonderful feeling knowing that I helped a lost soul find his way home. When they led him up that scaffold, they asked him if he had anything to say. And he told the crowd that he wasn't afraid to die because he was going to heaven. He told them how he asked God to forgive him, and he had. And he also told them that they should accept Christ into their hearts before it was too late. Then he said, "All right, I'm ready." The hangman placed a black hood over his head, put the rope around his neck, and pulled the handle for the trap door in the floor. George's body was left hanging at the bottom of the scaffold, but his soul flew straight into the arms of God.
Melody and Chester were looking on, and he said to Melody, "Well, that could have been me. I'm so thankful that it was Jed that brought me in. I'm also thankful for your father's help. Without him getting the lawyer, I'd probably have gone to prison or possibly joined George on that scaffold. But most of all, I'm thankful for you, for standing by me and loving me. I love you, sweetheart."
"And I love you," she said.
Chapter 28. Right after the hanging, Orville and Halfloaf showed up. I was so glad to see my two best friends. We talked for hours about their trip and about all the things that happened here. I talked to Orville into cooking me some of his smothered steak that I like so much. It was sure a good feeling to be reunited with them again. We set up a camp behind the livery stable, and we were enjoying our meal and fellowship when the mayor showed up. "Telegram came for you a little while ago," the mayor said, and he handed it to me. I sat back down on the overturned barrel and opened up the envelope. It read, "My name is Enoch Belfast. I'm an average citizen in Devil's Dance, Dakota Territory. I'm sending this to you because I was told you could help with my problem. The town's mayor, council, and sheriff are running roughshod over our town, and I'm afraid for the safety of everyone. No one has been hurt yet, but these men are becoming more ruthless every day. If you could find your way clear to come and help us, it would be greatly appreciated. I'm sorry to say, there would be no reward for you other than the satisfaction of ridding the town of these would-be leaders of society. Sincerely, Enoch Belfast." I folded the paper, put it back in the envelope, and stuffed it in my pocket.
"You got some bad news there, do you?" asked Orville.
"Well, it seems we're going to be taking a trip to Devil's Dance, Dakota Territory," I said.
"Well, when are we going to be leaving?" asked Orville.
"As soon as I pick up my gear at the hotel and you fellas get packed, we'll buy tickets and leave on the next train." "Well, the whole town wishes you would stay," said the mayor. "I wish you'd stay. However, I understand that you can't. God bless you, Jed. Godspeed."
"I'll take good care of your horses till you return," said Josh.
"Well, thanks to both of you. I hope and pray that everything works out for Chester and Melody. And good day to you." I told Orville and Halfloaf that I had some things to do and would meet them at the train depot. Then I walked back to the hotel. Oscar was missing from his post at the desk again. I picked up my key and walked up the stairs to Pepper's room, and it was a wonderful sound to hear the laughter coming from the other side of the door. I knocked and opened it myself. "Hello, folks. Just wanted to tell you I have to leave town," I said. "However, there is a possibility that I will be coming back. I wanted to wish both of you the best, and I hope you'll both be very happy. May God bless you both." "Well, thank you, Jed," said Oscar. "Pepper has agreed to marry me and help me here at the hotel. Isn't that great?" Pepper looked at me and winked. I winked back and nodded and then turned and went next door to my room, stuffed all my dirty clothes into my haversack, and left.
Chapter 29. I met my friends at the depot. We bought tickets and found out that if it arrived on time, the train would be leaving in half an hour. We paid for our tickets, then sat on the bench to wait for the northbound express. I leaned back against the wall and thought about everything that had occurred in my life since I left Angel Falls. Don't know why, but I had been tired as of late. I was dozing when I was awakened by the sound of the train whistle.
"Them Dakota territories is an outlaw's paradise," said Orville. "Untamed and uncivilized, that's what I heard. Bad place for a person to be going to, if you ask me."
"Well, I don't think we can let that get in our way," I said. "If there is someone that needs our help, then we are obligated to help them. But you don't have to go if you don't want to."
"Never said I didn't want to go," said Orville. "I was just explaining about the country there. Come on, let's get our tickets, get aboard. I'm looking forward to this here train ride."
We got aboard and found a seat, Orville and me facing the front and Halfloaf facing the rear. It was going to be another one of those long trips. Maybe, like the last time, I'd met a pretty girl to converse with along the way. But before I knew it, the train gave a jerk, and we were on our way, bound for Devil's Dance, Dakota Territory.
This has been Windy Butte, New Mexico, The Traveler, Book 6, written by J.C. Halsey, narrated by Chaz Allen. Copyright September 17th, 2014, by J.C. Halsey. Production copyright
2016, by Outlaws Publishing, LLC.